Hello, welcome to Newspeak, the New Culture Forum's weekly look at the news agenda. I am joined, as usual, I'm pleased to say, by Rafe Hadel-Mankou, our senior fellow and world commentator and historian, and Amy Gallagher, who is the SDP's candidate for the London mayoralty, as well as being the campaigner behind Stand Up To Woke. Before we go, actually, Rafe, you were in the Express recently, weren't you?
Oh gosh, yes, they did a very nice.
Life as a royal commentator.
As a royal historian, I prefer to royal commentator. Everybody these days is a royal commentator. So I try to say historian, but yes, the Daily Express have just launched in America, and so they chose to have their first royal feature on yours truly, which was a rather nice surprise for
them.
How
can people see that then? Where can they?
Oh, if they just Google my name and Daily Express, I suppose.
Right, okay.
And it was rather nice of them to do that.
Great, good. Before we go any further, actually, two notifications, actually, of our locals events. As you know, these have been going great guns. We had a fantastic one in London, actually, this past week, very pleased to say. But there are two coming up. The first one is this coming Tuesday, actually, the 12th of March. It is in Nottingham. It's in the evening. It's totally free. So if you're in Nottingham or nearabouts, please do come and join us. And it'll be great to meet you and see you. And then the second one is in Southampton on the 19th of March, the following week, again in the evening, again, it's totally free. If you want details of venues, then please do write to locals@newcultureforum.org.uk. People always have a good time when they come to our events. And these will be no exception, I'm sure. So I hope maybe to see you there. It's been quite a week, but all along, I would say the similar lines, I think. But want to start, actually, we've had the budget. The actual budget itself is so boring, I wouldn't put you through actually having to, you know, talk about it. But I do think that there are some interesting things that arose from it, starting with the very first line, which was when Jeremy Hunt said, we're going to be giving £1 million to a new memorial to Muslim soldiers killed in First and Second World Wars. Rafe, we've already got that, haven't we?
Yes, well, I mean, we have. In 2002, Her Late Majesty the Queen unveiled on Constitution Hill, just next to Buckingham Palace, the Commonwealth Gates, which were deliberately designed to commemorate all those from the subcontinent and the Caribbean who fought in the Second World Wars. And it's a wonderful and a very huge memorial of different sections for different parts of the Commonwealth, but it includes India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and the Caribbean. And it's got a wonderful sort of Mughal Islamic dome inside which all the Victoria Cross holders are inscribed. And it's the scene for, you know, all sorts of ceremonies already. So why there needed to be at this precise moment a memorial dedicated to Muslims, I don't really understand. I mean, this is a discussion of two parts. One is, why was this announcement made now in the manner it was, and what is the reason behind it? And then two, there's a separate discussion of, do we actually need this memorial at all? And I think it's quite remarkable, given the scenes that we've seen every weekend in London, every Saturday, that the first line of a budget was dedicated to this, almost as if it's appeasement. You know, we had Rishi Sunak, and of course this comment was made in the context of tackling extremism. You know, as if those people who are suicide bombers and who create attacks on the streets with machetes and so forth, as if they're going to be somehow convinced by the erection of a monument. I mean, these people don't even know what the Second World War is, I would imagine, half of them. And I think it's such a naive thing when, you know, money should be focused on actually tackling the root causes of Islam. You get this sort of a stop, and I think it generally is appeasement. And isn't it funny, when people condemn extremism, they have to mention the mythical far right here. Mm-hmm. We saw that on 10 Downing Street, we saw Sunak giving them both equal measure. So I'm surprised, but when it comes to giving money out, somehow this mythical far right don't get it. Yeah. I mean, perhaps there should have been an announcement of a statue of Enoch Powell was going to be erected as well in Birmingham or Parliament Square to appease the mythical far right. Why didn't we get any of that? I think the timing stinks, and I think the messaging behind it stinks. But we can then, if you want, have another discussion about whether we actually need that type of memorial.
Well, yes, exactly. You mentioned the one that it's actually quite, well, modern, isn't it? The one in Constitution Hill, although it's been beautifully done, so it doesn't look modern. It looks like Nebwood Lutyens, doesn't it?
Precisely.
But I think the main point really as well here is that, you know, if you go to the cenotaph, it's got the glorious dead on it. It doesn't have the glorious Christians. It doesn't have the glorious white men. It has the glorious dead, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of war memorials are just to the dead, as you say, but there has been an increasing amount of war memorials for particular identity groups. So next to the cenotaph, there is a memorial for women.
Exactly.
And then on Marble Arch, there's one for animals in the war. Mm. And then there have been kind of poppies and statues erected for Sikhs in World War and World War II. Mm. So this is, you know, people could argue this is just a continuation of that. You know, I think I'd prefer it if we just left out all identity categories and just did, you know, the memorials just for the dead of you know, all faiths and none. But, you know, this is the direction we've gone in. So you could argue this is just this memorial for Muslims is just an extension of that. But as Rafe said, I mean, the timing is just unbelievable. We've seen in the last 4 months the absolute desecration and complete disrespect for war memorials. Mm. It's still very much fresh in all of our minds, I think. We've seen the cenotaph have to be cordoned off and made into an exclusion zone to protect it from the pro-Palestinian protests. We've seen graffiti on a memorial in Rochdale saying pro-Palestine. We've seen people climbing on the tops of memorials, burning flags, etc. And this is really, I think, for a lot of us, has really wounded us. It's been hard to see. And as I said, it's still very much in our minds. And, you know, obviously, a lot of the people who have been doing this are extremist Islamists and Muslim groups, not all Muslims, of course, there's many moderate Muslims. But it has been that particular group that have shown a complete and utter disrespect for our Remembrance Sunday and our memorials. So the idea that you would start a budget, I mean, this is the going to be the last budget before the election, announcing this just seems like a complete, absolute lack of understanding to how the public are feeling about what's happened over the last 4 months. And just a complete slap in the face, I think.
I found it cringe-making to the point of making me angry. I mean, you know, in the sense that it's just so craven.
Craven and so obvious. But you know, Amy's quite correct. You know, there are different memorials. I mean, you know, my mother's Polish and I supported the erection of a Polish war memorial in the National Arboretum. You know, the Poles in the Battle of Britain, the 303 Squadron was the final squadron in the Battle of Britain. Chief Marshal Dowding said if it wasn't for the Poles, we'd have lost the Battle of Britain. But those are national identities of national armies fighting. It's very different when you're distinguishing people by basis of religion. Yes, the Sikhs and the Gurkhas both have their own memorials, but that's rather different because the Sikhs and the Gurkhas were tiny groups and they're almost an ethnic identity unto themselves. They're almost their own sort of nations, and their fighting prowess and loyalty to the crown for hundreds of years, I think, merited that because they were fighting units no different to the SAS or the Royal Marines in how they fought. And, you know, Sikhs were 2% of the population of India, and they were 30% of the Victoria Crosses that were run. But once you get into this idea, you know, they're an ethnic-based religion. Is Christianity and Islam cross boundaries? These aren't national identities in any sort of sense. And I think it's very divisive when you're trying to actually promote a sense of Britishness to start subdividing people up into their different categories.
Well, I'd say that almost people have tacitly given up on that, actually, trying to promote that. And also, it's actually a fact, isn't it? That in fact, the idea of nationhood is very, very weak in, say, like Muslim countries. You know, it is because your main loyalty is to Islam. And that's the sort of fact, you know, which in fact, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing, except for when you're trying to promote some kind of theory, which is what they've been trying to do now for God knows how many years. You know, but
well,
I just think
it's a far bigger phenomenon, this identifying as being Muslim first and British second. It's a far bigger phenomenon here than it is, for example, in Germany or surprisingly in France. Now, we think about France having far worse tensions with the Islamic community, yet actually far more Muslims, or I think twice the number of Muslims, identify as being French first and Muslim second as we have in this country. I think it's because France actively promotes a very secular sort of a concept which appeals to some Muslims, but of course antagonizes other Muslims even more. But we have a bigger problem here with Muslims, a large number of Muslims. I mean, the majority do try to assimilate, but a large number don't, and they do prioritize their faith over their nation.
Don't you sort of think, though, for me, it's cut and dried, really. We had Sunak on the steps of Downing Street talking about Islamist extremism, but of course, couldn't just leave it at that, had to bring in the far right. Now we have them doing this at the budget, the first line of a budget, talking about Muslim. You would think, well, it's extraordinary when you think of what's, as you say, it's been happening over the past few months, that actually this is now the emphasis, is somehow or other to take away, you know, the emphasis, take away the spotlight from Islam, from Muslims.
It's really mixed messages as well, like Sunak coming out and talking about the threats of Islamic extremism, and then in the next week you the budget is started with a memorial for Muslims. Yes. It's really confusing. Are they supposed to assimilate or not? Is this an issue? Is it not? Can this be part of British values or not? It's really, I always feel like the political class just don't know what to do, and they're just lurching from one thing to the next to try to solve this issue.
I just don't think, well, actually the one thing that struck me about Sunak, actually, when I was watching him, it was in fact how you felt that these subjects were sort of almost new to him. He'd given them no thought whatsoever. In his kind of atmosphere, in his stratosphere, no thought to them. He's entirely a technocrat and an economic one at that. And so it had the feeling of, you know, what was he was mentioning, like Nick Griffith. I mean, most people watching that, or young people, won't even know who that was.
It's like he's
know?
Just Googled.
Why well, he's the very definition of an anywhere other than a somewhere. Yeah. Much happier in California talking to tech giants. And you know that from the fact that when he announced his five priorities for his government when he was elected, when it came to immigration, he just said stop the small boats. He never even considered legal immigration. And this man is completely out of touch with all of these sorts of issues.
We mentioned their values, right, and extremism. Actually, far more important, not you know, symbolically, it's very important, this memorial, far more important, is this new idea that there is, or an idea for a new revised definition of extremism generally. Extremism, of course, again, generally sort of trying to take, you know, the spotlight away from the main extremist danger. And this is going to be coming down the line this month, maybe even next week, actually. And this is sort of under the auspices of Michael Gove. Right. Apparently, given the state of play now, what we use as a definition of extremism is no longer good enough, or in the current phrase, fit for purpose. Best thing to do, I'm going to read, this is what the definition of extremism is now, and this is the one that used by PREVENT, you know, the anti-extremist strategy program. Okay, the government has defined extremism in the PREVENT strategy as, quote, vocal or active opposition to fundamental British values, including democracy, the rule of law, individual liberty, and mutual respect and tolerance of different faiths and beliefs. Right. So basically, vocal or active opposition. This one, I mean, you could say that's very problematic anyway, right? It's pretty banal, it seems to me. They don't seem especially British values. But how, what on earth, you know, would they have to do to make that more all-encompassing? I mean, this is actually what is going to come down the line. What does it mean? You know, what will become, how will you actually broaden that? Thinking these things as opposed to just being vocal about them?
Well, being permissive, but like even if you're not an extremist, if you downplay extremism, that will fall foul of it, you know? And there are all sorts of small C conservative organizations and groups which will fall foul of this, because who's defining extremism is the all-important thing here. What's extremist to us won't be extremist to other people, whereas we will find what they're saying is extremist. J.K. Rowling, who is so moderate, is regarded as an extremist by trans radical activists, for example. You know, the Pope's views are extremist to some Catholics. I mean, it's such a nebulous term, and it's so dangerous for the Conservative government. This is what's so outrageous. Is, you know, in this dying embers, the Conservative government is giving a gift to Labour. Because when Labour gets in, we know full well how that Overton window shifts and how they're liable to find what were mainstream views extremist It's going to encompass all manner of bodies and organizations. Now, this is about undermining British values. That's one of the part of the new definition, undermining of British values. We don't even know what British values are. This has been one of the great questions of the last 20 years. What are British values? Everyone has their own set of values. It's such a dangerous thing. Now, it must be said, this is not going to become a criminal issue. It's not statutory. It's about deciding what organizations and people the government will actually interact with and fund. But it's the beginning, it's a thin end of the wedge, I think.
Oh, definitely. It sets the tone, I think. You know, particularly with this report, which I'm talking about tomorrow on my show, banning Islamophobia, blasphemy law by the back door. This came out this week by Tim Dieppe. He's done it for the Free Speech Union. It's all part of the same thing. If there is a Labour government, that will be almost certainly embedded in law, which is very, very worrying. To go back to this definition thing, though, I mean, how would you define, this is a really tough one, how would you define British values? If someone said to you, Amy, come on, you're on this show, Rafe, you're on the show, what are British values? Right. If I have anyone say to me yet again, what is British culture anyway, right? They always say that. And I've now got an answer to come back with. What about values? Is it even the right thing to talk about values in something like that?
I guess I'd link it to our history, like common law, monarchy,
history.
Parliament, history and freedom of speech, freedom of consciousness, kind of Western values, I guess, but then particularly British values, you know, British constitutions like the monarchy and Parliament. And just, I guess, our general, I guess our kind of way, our civility, our kind of, we're, you know, kind of how we act, something like that, which is hard to define, but we're very polite, we're very, in opposition to Americans, we're quite quiet, we're quite mild-mannered. That's kind of how I think of being British, but it is hard to define. And, you know, I just think putting British values into legislation is just crazy, because it will immediately be attacked, you know, whatever it is.
I tend to always talk about it in historic terms, but also characteristics such as, I mean, it sounds like a nebulous one, but fairness, is quite British. It's not necessary in the rest of the world.
I said that there are no such thing as British values. Mm. I mean, you know, Sid Vicious and Johnny Rotten are as much British as people as Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher, and you wouldn't say that they share many values in common, right? You know, look at Thomas Paine and the whole Republican movement that existed that gave birth to the American Revolution, compared to, I don't know, say David Hume and so forth. So there's a huge difference. I think there are characteristics and traits of the British people which we can discuss. Fairness, and also we have to also say much of this is actually Englishness. Mm-hmm. You know, the greatest qualities of the English nation were woven into the British fabric, and it's time that I think people began to recognise and reclaim some of those things. But yeah, fairness, playing things by the rules, all of those sorts of things, politeness. But and then of course there are what I would call the foundations of British civilization, which is common law, the rule of law, parliamentary democracy, all this respect for institutions. And so forth, but I don't like this term of values.
No, I think what we're both talking about is actually character, aren't we? We're talking about character as formed by history. So in other words, we're talking about like a person's character and what they are, they are a sum total of their history, are they not, and what they've experienced. I mean, I would add, though, when we're talking about characteristics, I would add generally a skepticism about ideology. That's always been a kind of pragmatism, a sort of I think someone once almost referred to it as come off itism. You know, in fact, people don't even say come off it anymore, really. But you know that, oh, come on. In other words, none of your flim flam. It's a sort of a practical thing. I think that's quite a British thing.
But I think the most important thing is simply love of country, and a passion for the countryside, for its history and for its heritage. Mm. Can't really describe that sort of emotional feel. It's not unique to Britain. I would imagine that, you know, Spanish and French feel the same way. But, you know, that's, you know, I think that should be the paramount thing. And anything that undermines that, I think we should say is a bad thing.
Well, I think in the 20th century, we avoided fascism and communism. We've never had a kind of a real authoritarian state in the way that other countries have. And I think coming back to war memorials, you know, that's kind of one of our foundation stories now, you know, Churchill and how we fought in the war. I think though that to me feels like British values, which is why people feel so emotional when more morals are attacked, because it does feel like something innately British that is being destroyed.
Well, I think we've got more than any other country in the world.
Well, that's an important point, because as we've seen the decline of religion, Remembrance Sunday has become our sort of national religion. Mm-hmm. That is the religious ceremony for the nation to come together and have their 2 minute silence. And it's the one time of the year when we actually go to our local memorials, and it does become something sort of sacred.
Yes, exactly, which is the reason why people obviously go for them. Speaking of kind of generally kind of being ashamed or not of your past, the Church of England this week, they have a fund, which is, if you like, to, it's like a form, for argument's sake, it's like a reparations, right? It's basically to help black businesses across the world because of the residual remains of slavery and what the effect slavery has had. And it was for £100 million. They want to raise it to £1 billion. They want to raise this. They haven't got £1 billion. They want to raise this money because this, of course, in their eyes, is a mortal sin which took place. And so they sort of want to atone for it, it seems to me. But frankly, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it, in this day and age, that there was no talk whatsoever of using any of this money to maybe fight slavery as it exists now, which I think is far more widespread even. It's entirely down to the transatlantic part of it. That's what they're concerned about.
Yeah, as you said, there's more slavery now today than there was at the height of the transatlantic slave trade. I think the Church of England and many of our institutions, they find it so much easier to look at the past because the problems that we have today are so difficult to face and think about. You know, they're saying that the Church of England, I think the argument is that the Church of England invested funds into a company several hundred years ago that was responsible for transporting slaves. But we all have phones in our pockets that are made from cobalt or made from materials where there's still slavery and terrible inhuman conditions happening now. But the Church of England doesn't seem to have any interest in that, because if you then you have to actually face, you know, the real world problems and think about how problems could actually be solved. They don't want to do that. They just want to, you know, just protest and do activism. And that's what this is. And I think it's devastating that the Church of England is going along with this. It's just becoming ever more and more political, more and more race stuff. And Justin Welby is letting it all happen. He's going along with it. So it's, it's not good.
Well, yeah, well,
£1 billion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said before, Church of England used to be called the Conservative Party of Prayer, but now it seems more like BLM at prayer when you see this sort of thing being done. And just imagine if you're one of those people who were a victim of sex abuse at the hands of the Anglican Church. Mm-hmm. You know, 2018, I think it was, Welby promised £200 million compensation to victims of church sex abuse. And here we are 6 years later, and they're still awaiting payment. Mm. And then they see here, they're the living victims of the church, and they see here money being given to people who have no connection whatsoever with slavery. We're talking about 8 generations back. And isn't it, it's the ultimate in immoral perversity, I think, to prioritize dead people from 200 years ago over living victims today. And this money is, you know, should be going, as you said, to things like fighting slavery around the world, or compensating these people, repairing church roofs, helping our homeless. There's so much real work that could be done with so much money. It's also going to disincentivize donors. Old ladies who normally in their will would leave their house and so forth will be thinking, well, why should I if my house is going to go to this program? And this money is going to black-led schemes. So the recipients of this, you know, could very well be people whose ancestors have nothing to do with slavery in the first place, or even they could go to the millions of Africans who descend from African slave owners. They could be the ones actually who end up benefiting from this money. And it's immensely patronizing to black people, because what the church is actually saying is, all black people, whoever you are, you're all victims of slavery. And I think that's an absolute absurdity.
No, it's absurdity, but, you know, as you say, completely to be expected from a church which it seems to me is now entirely captured anyway by critical race theory, because only last week, I think it was, in the West Midlands, they are about to appoint a deconstructing whiteness officer for 36,000 quid. Deconstructing whiteness. Now, this is not about, slavery is the way into this, isn't it? Mm. That's the why it's the way in for critical race theory. But essentially, deconstructing whiteness, it's a pathology. Mm. You know, this is the church doing this.
Yeah, I mean, there's more and more of these stories coming through. There was one about the Bishop of Dover, I believe, wanting to institute a race action plan to make sure there's more black and ethnic minority priests, which are underrepresented in the Church of England. I mean, even Justin Welby recently said that, you know, the Rwanda plan goes against the nature of God. He's acting more like a Labour MP than the Archbishop of Canterbury. But yeah, this critical race theory is totally destroying the church. And the point is, it's not just destroy it. The ideas that they are pushing are actually anti-Christian, right? So the Christian faith believes that everybody is equal in the eyes of God. And it also believes that you're not responsible for the sins of the father. You're not responsible for the sins of someone who has the same skin color as you. You're not responsible for the sins of people 100 years ago, 200 years ago, or anything that happened. You're only responsible for you, and you have a direct, you know, relationship with God. So it seems to me that this is a complete reversal of the Christian faith for this new religion, which is this religion of Black Lives Matter and woke. It's a complete existential crisis. I don't even think many of these people, you can even call them Christians. They just
perhaps they're not, actually.
Mm. Yeah,
well, perhaps they're actually not.
30 or 40 years ago, the church would have been celebrating its pivotal role in abolishing the slave trade. If it wasn't for the Church of England, slavery would not have been abolished. And the slave trade would not have been abolished, perhaps for decades, who knows, maybe 100 years more. Mm. And it was just a couple of miles from here in Clapham, at Holy Trinity Church Clapham, where William Wilberforce and what was called the Clapham sect got together, these evangelicals, who then lobbied the government constantly about this. And that evangelical reformation was unique to world history. Slavery is universal, but it was in this little island that this movement of evangelicalism changed the course of the British Empire, that spent the second half of its existence atoning for the sin of slavery. And it was the Anglican Church that led that. And that should be a source of pride, and there should be a plaque commemorating that on every Church of England thing here. Instead of that, they're constantly doing this nihilistic, self-indulgent horsehair whipping of themselves. And I just think, you know, this is just another case of this long war of attrition that seeks to disconnect the people from their past, make them people who loathe where their country came from. And it's a process of demoralization, which is at the heart of cultural Marxism.
Do you know, it's interesting, I was watching a film last night called The Monument Men. Do you know that movie with George Clooney? And he has a line in it where he says, you can burn people's houses, it's set during the Second World War, you can burn people's houses down, but eventually they sort of will come back. He said, but take away their monuments and history, and that's it, they're gone. Mm. And their achievements. Mm. And I just thought, this is extraordinary, actually, in a film. You know, obviously, we're very alive to all this all the time. But just one more point on the church as well, is that, which rather supports the idea that they're entirely political, not even naive. This kind of rote they had for getting asylum seekers, you know, successful applications with their, you know, conversions to Christianity.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sorry, I don't believe that they really think these guys, I think that they just simply, it's a political thing. It's entirely a political thing.
They loathe the Tory party and they want to have a go at them. I'm sure there are some doddering old vicars who do fall for this, but you're quite right. Many of them aren't that foolish to think that. And it's, you know, and then it's upon their shoulders that rests the burden whenever one of those people that they help to come over ends up committing an atrocity or raping somebody.
By the way, I mean, we are talking actually obviously about the Church of England here. We're not talking about the Catholic Church, for example. I mean, that's a whole different programme, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the more Orthodox churches is where people are turning to. And the Church of England is just, I mean, I suspect these asylum seekers that turn up, I don't know if it's, some priests must just feel so excited to have somebody come, because we know that the church attendance is plummeting. Mm. But you think, of course, it would be obvious that given that nobody is coming to these churches, these people just rock up, you know, as asylum seekers, that it wouldn't occur to them that maybe there's something up. But I think, you know, I think some people genuinely feel that making the church go more woke will bring young people in or bring more pimp, but it absolutely won't. It'll do the complete opposite.
Well, the most remarkable thing, of course, is that, you know, apostasy is the worst thing a Muslim can commit. It's probably worse than murder, right? Leaving the faith. We know that the majority of Muslims in parts of the world believe you should be put to death if you leave the faith. So the idea that someone's going to come here and suddenly overnight say, get fall to the knee and say, hallelujah, where's the next tea party going on, vicar? I think it's for the birds. And there's the whole concept of takia in Islam, right? Which is basically misleading the enemy and pretending to be something you aren't in order to advance Islam. And that's all going on here. And it's, you know, it's a degree of disingenuity, if that's a word, and it's the naivety of these people which really is beyond belief.
Yes, exactly. But you know, when I go into some churches, and I went into one recently, it's beautiful. It's the same thing. It's this thing of the buildings being the same, but the people being different. When I go in and you see the volunteers, and they're not all old people, I get the same feeling I do when I'm often when I'm in a the NHS, in a ward in the NHS, I get the feeling that these people are sort of not, you know, they just automatically, politically are not with me. It's an interesting thing. You used to feel that on the South Bank when Ken Livingston was around still. It used to emanate this kind of left-wing-ishness. It's very hard to explain quite, but I sort of feel that even in churches now, you know? Where is there left to go? Well, right here. Every Saturday. thanks very much, Amy. Thanks very much. And we shall see you next week. Okay, take care. Chin up.
Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.